You're listening to the Seasteading Today podcast, where we speak to entrepreneurs and researchers who are making the dream of seasteading a reality. The Seasteading Today podcast. Stop arguing and start seasteading.
Hello, seasteaders. This is Carly Jackson on the Seasteading Today podcast. My guest today is Michael Strong, author of The Habit of Thought and Be the Solution, and founder of the Academy of Thought and Industry. He's also a co-founder of Conscious Capitalism and a former board member of the Seasteading Institute. I have been lucky to know Michael for a few years through the activist community in Austin, Texas. He's always a wealth of knowledge, no matter what topic we discuss. Our conversation gives an historical perspective to the kind of progress that seasteading can bring to humanity at large. Enjoy our interview with Michael Strong. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Delightful to be here, Carly.
So tell us a little how you got involved with seasteading.
Sure. So, you know, everything's complicated, but I'll try to do a simple version. I am an education entrepreneur. I create innovative schools. And in the early 2000s, I met John Mackey, CEO of Whole Foods. He and I both believed in entrepreneurial solutions to world problems. I mean, we're essentially libertarians, but instead of being against taxes and regulations, we're for entrepreneurial solutions. And I started looking around at the biggest and most important entrepreneurial solutions. And the biggest problem of all is inept, incompetent, dysfunctional government around the world. One could argue that government is the least innovative industry in the entire world. And one really direct impact of that is poverty. You know, if everyone in the world lived in governments that had the rule of law and economic freedom of Hong Kong and Singapore, there would be no more mass poverty. Hong Kong and Singapore went from basically poor to rich in 50 years because of their legal systems. And if we had legal systems like that available to the entire 7 billion people on Earth, we'd have extraordinary prosperity. And so it was through this lens of how do we innovate with legal systems that I started connecting with Patry Friedman, one of the founders of Seasteading, and Patry invited me to join the board. And, you know, he and I were both bloggers with quite a few other people on Let a Thousand Nations Bloom, where we were exploring the notion. Peter Thiel had said, the future of humanity depends on if we have 1,000 nations 20 years from now or just a couple dozen. Because if the oligopoly of governments shrinks so that we have fewer and fewer choices, think EU-ification of the entire world, then the future is grim. But if we have thousands of different innovative possibilities, then we will innovate and create prosperity more rapidly than ever. So that's basically how I got into seasteading, and it's, you know, arguably one of the most exciting realms for innovating in governance.
So I'd like to start with talking a little bit about Shenzhen as an example of a successful special economic zone. So will you define what a special economic zone is?
Sure. So go way back. Some of the earliest, the ancient trading cities, the free ports throughout history, and things like the Hanseatic League, where there were commercial entities that had autonomy vis-a-vis the local, what became nation states. But the more recent history of zones really is from the, say, 1930s, when governments were eliminating trade around the world. And so gradually, because it was hard to create opportunities for trade at a nation state level, a free zone industry grew up, which allowed for sometimes export processing. So the zone would simply be focused on products for export, and that way it didn't interfere with their rent-seeking establishment within the country. But these zones that were carve-outs within a national system that typically had reduced taxes and regulations, fewer trade barriers, those sorts of things, by the time Shenzhen was started in the 80s, there were hundreds of different zones around the world. And the Chinese were very practical. They looked around and they saw that Hong Kong and Singapore had become incredibly prosperous. And so they modeled the early special economic zones on Hong Kong and Singapore. It took a while for them to be successful. So I believe Shenzhen was started 1979, 1980, right around there. And even by the late 80s, there's a newspaper clipping from 86 saying basically Shenzhen was a failure. So one of the things we all have to remember, these are long-term projects. You can't look 6 years in and say, oh, nothing happened. Because it was shortly after that that foreign direct investment started pouring into Shenzhen. Now Shenzhen is the world's leading manufacturing center. There are estimates that land values have gone up 18,000%. There are hundreds of millions of people that have escaped poverty, special economic zones up and down the Chinese coast and sometimes in the interior, have led the growth in Chinese prosperity, where 30 years ago, the average per capita income in China was $1,000 per person. Today, it's estimated somewhere between $6,000 to $10,000 per person. And for, I say hundreds of millions because there's still poorer people in the interior of China, and of course some who are still lower income on the urban areas, but the average urban wages going up to 5x to 10x what they were, and those average urban wages benefiting hundreds of millions of people, almost a billion people. Never before in human history have so many people escaped poverty so rapidly.
That's one of the questions I kind of want to dig into, that we can look at statistics, and the seasteading book lists a few of that 15 years after Shenzhen was founded, property values rose 8,000%. And after 30 years, property values rose 18,000%. But how can we know that the rising property values is truly creating wealth, or is not just a displacement, or how can we evaluate those numbers to understand what quality of life changes are happening in the special
economic zone? So a couple of things. One is just visually, and this something similar has happened in Dubai. You can see that there was nothing there. In the photo of Shenzhen in 1980, there's nothing there, basically. This tiny fishing village. And so certainly it's gone from a rural land that's not very valuable. To take a more familiar example, Las Vegas, Nevada, in 1920, there was basically nothing in Las Vegas. 1930, nothing in Las Vegas. You know, now, for decades, Las Vegas has been one of the fastest growing cities in the U.S., and there are a lot of jobs there. And those jobs cumulatively have a very substantial payroll. So that's why when I focus on the average urban wages in Shenzhen, often people alleviate poverty by donating money. You know, the philosopher Peter Singer wants us to give a significant portion of our income to other people. The fact is, even if all of us gave away half of our income, we could not create the wealth that was created in China. That's why the phrase wealth creation is important. There were, some on the order of a billion poor people in China who were in many cases, in these ineffective factories or ineffective agricultural co-ops, and they were not producing, and it's not blaming them in any sense, incredibly hardworking people. But because the legal system did not allow for entrepreneurial value creation, their labor did not result in prosperity for them. So the whole benefit of basically a free market legal system where entrepreneurs can create new products and services and create the manufacturing foundations that will allow those workers to produce iPhones instead of cheap plastic toys, people go up the value chain. So as they develop the skills to manufacture more sophisticated products, their wages go up. The wages are bid up. There are articles on the end of cheap Chinese labor. So one way to think about this is Shenzhen was empty with the population of China spread across the nation, relatively speaking. As it created a special economic zone that allowed for radical free markets relative to what had been before, you had tens of millions of people moving into Shenzhen over decades, incredible rate. And initially they'd get there and they were poor and they didn't have a job and it was tough. But because so many things were being manufactured in Shenzhen, there was a constant hunger for more workers. And gradually, as they developed more skills, those workers' wages were bid up. Again, it's not through any kind of kindness that the for-profit corporations started paying the workers 5 to 10 times as much. And I say that because there are uncertainties around Chinese numbers in a variety of sense, but unambiguously much higher numbers. But it's as you have to compete for the workers who can really create great iPhones, that's when you start to pay them more. And eventually, although there took a long time, their first decade or so, wages did not go up at all, hardly, in China, first decade of the manufacturing revolution. But gradually, there were more jobs than people. And so the for-profit greedy companies had to pay the people more. And as a consequence, their lives improved. You can look at the increase in protein consumption or the increased sales of bicycles or increase in electrification. By almost any metric, the average worker, working class Chinese has become middle class by global standards. And there are so many different lines of evidence that show that that this has taken place that no reasonable person can doubt it at this point.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like what the key piece of what makes a special economic zone a special economic zone is that you have to allow the free movement of goods and the free movement of people. Would you say that's correct?
Exactly. I mean, a simple, you know, it's funny. I know people on the left who deny that there's such a thing as economic freedom, but my wife's from Africa where it's obvious. My wife needs to get permission from the state to fire an employee. You know, and if you have to get permission from the state to fire an employee, you're very cautious about whether or not you hire anybody. As my wife says, if I can't fire you, I can't hire you. And if you do have to get permission from the state to fire somebody, if you're in a volatile business, and most businesses are volatile, you know, one month you have 20% increase in orders and a 50% slouch in orders and a 70% increase. It's common in many, many businesses, especially rapidly growing ones, to have huge fluctuations. And you need to be able to hire and lay people off as the business demands impact. That's just one example. A different example is just how long does it take to start up a business? Hernando de Soto, the Peruvian economist, showed decades ago that most poor countries around the world, it could take a year to start up a legal business. Hong Kong, you walk in and, you know, 15 minutes you can start a business. So in I would say normally people should be allowed, if you and I want to, if I want to buy some lemonade from you and your lemonade stand out front, you make lemonade, I buy lemonade, done. But every layer of government that controls the interaction reduces the extent to which these entrepreneurial activities take place. So one way to think about poor countries around the world is there's this horrific kind of red tape. You picture these images of people just tangling. In Senegal, I see Magat is drowning in molasses to get anything done. Everywhere you try to move, you've got to get a permission or a permit, or you need to file some paperwork, or you need to pay a fee. And each one may be relatively modest, but cumulatively they kill commerce. Mm-hmm. And so places like Hong Kong, Singapore, and then Shenzhen simply reduced the restrictions so that people could engage one another freely. Leonard Reed, the founder of the Foundation for Economic Education, famously said, anything that's peaceful. So as long as you and I are not doing anything that's harming other people, why shouldn't we be allowed to do it? And voila, that creates prosperity.
You know, and this is a constant curiosity to me, that when people like you present this evidence and talk about why we need more liberty and less regulation, there's still a resistance to it. Do you have a sense of why people resist that? Is there a fear, or, you know, I just want to try and understand why people aren't convinced by this.
No, that's a really great question. I think a lot of it is the anti-capitalist, I'll call them the anti-capitalist movement. You know, Deirdre McCloskey, the economic historian, describes it as the treason of the intellectuals, that basically from Adam Smith through about 1848, most intellectuals were classical liberals, pro-market. At the French Revolution, the pro-market people sat on the left side. To be a leftist at the time of the French Revolution was to be a free marketeer. And that was the case more or less until around 1848. And then there was this intellectual rebellion against capitalism. And of course, Marx is a huge influence here. And unfortunately, this is an intellectual mistake. Hayek describes socialism as an intellectual mistake. 1 + 1 = 7. 1 + 1 = 2. And so likewise, for me personally, one of the big events in my transition from being anti-capitalist to being pro-capitalist was to learn that during the Industrial Revolution, the standard of the working class improved and dramatically improved. And so I had been taught by all of the intellectual sources and the professors that under capitalism, under laissez-faire capitalism, the rich got richer, the poor got poorer. That was just false. It wasn't perfect laissez-faire capitalism, but under the relative freedom of late 19th and century capitalism in the US and Britain, the working class increased its standard of living more rapidly than ever before in history. We should all be excited. Yes, there was labor unrest, and yes, there were complications, but if you look at the data, people are becoming more prosperous. And to this day, most people are unaware of this. To this day, most people are unaware of the dramatic increase in prosperity thanks to globalization and capitalism. Hans Rosling, famous for the Ignorance Project and some beautiful TED videos, did a survey where he found if you ask the average American, only 5% realize that poverty has decreased in the last 20 years. 70% believe that poverty has increased in the last 70 years. The rest think that poverty stayed the same. This is a ridiculous absurdity. So I think a big part of the reason people don't realize this is the anti-capitalists who mostly control academia, especially the kind of meaning side of academia, the humanities and the social sciences, especially outside of econ. Econ's not as crazy as the rest. But these people have taught generations to hate capitalism. They've either hidden or actively provided inaccurate information about the way in which capitalism increases prosperity. And so as a consequence, we have most people not knowing pretty basic facts. And one of the things I have wanted to do is to do an ignorance survey of humanities departments, where I think that most academic humanists really do not understand that poverty has decreased dramatically due to capitalism in the last 20, 30 years. So that's my simple answer, is they just don't know. And a different example, I'm trying to get the Ignorance Project to focus on the overregulation of Africa. Almost nobody knows that Africa is the most heavily regulated region on Earth. And a lot of this is the anti-capitalists have this narrative that neoliberalism has resulted in this dog-eat-dog global capitalism with the race to the bottom. Well, it turns out Shenzhen had one of the least regulated labor markets in the world, and Shenzhen employees became prosperous more rapidly than anyone. Meanwhile, in much of Asia and Latin America, and certainly in Africa, highly regulated labor markets, and they have not seen the same increases in prosperity. This is information that needs to get out there.
Well, and so we're talking about, a popular understanding of this, but you've been involved with trying to talk with government in different countries to establish special economic zones. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So I would certainly say there are smart people who completely understand the need for economic freedom and prosperity. So certainly, in Honduras passed legislation in 2000, I think it was 11, and then it was ruled unconstitutional in 2012. They passed new legislation allowing for new zones with their own law and governance. And so one of the aspects of global prosperity is you need high quality rule of law in order to create prosperity. And in many ways, the Anglo-American common law tradition is more favorable to commerce than is the civil law tradition coming out of France, Spain, and Portugal. So in general, former Anglo-American colonies, including Hong Kong and Singapore, tend to be more prosperous, whereas more former civil law countries, former French, Portuguese, and Spanish colonies, tend to be less prosperous. So the Honduran law actually allowed for zones that featured common law as a way to increase prosperity. And there are people inside the Honduran government who really understand this. Octavio Sanchez is a Harvard-educated attorney who worked with Hernando de Soto's team on property rights in Honduras, really brilliant guy. And he understands deeply the extent to which we need high quality property rights, rule of law, and economic freedom to create prosperity. In many countries around the world, there are people who get this. Often they are people focused on economic development or business. But they don't have the backing of the populace. So for instance, and nor do they have the backing of the intellectuals in many cases. So in Honduras, we were once told that 5% of the population would be against the, they were called ZEDES this time around, Zones for Economic Development Employment. The 5% of the population would be against them on anti-capitalist ground, 5% on kind of more right-wing sovereignty ground, because if you have common law, that's not Honduran law. But the 90% of them would be, don't believe it's going to happen, but if they did, they'd be in favor because they just want jobs. The vast majority of Hondurans, they just want a good job. They want to be able to take care of their family, educate their children, live in safety. Most people just want prosperity. And so insofar as we can get this message out there, that these zones, these islands of higher quality rule of law and governance are the path to prosperity, the vast majority of the world's population is going to be in favor of them. Meanwhile, you know, there was a Marxist professor at UC Santa Cruz who called herself a leading expert in Honduras, and she's an anti-capitalist who doesn't understand how capitalism creates prosperity, and so she was bashing these zones. A huge problem is that many of the world's intellectuals are, again, absolutely ignorant about how exactly capitalism leads to prosperity. And I see them as, you know, again, in Deirdre McCloskey's terms, treason. They're committing treason against the human beings, billions of human beings.
Okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about how seasteading is related to all the great examples you've talked about with special economic zones. Have you seen progress in the seasteading movement in the last couple of years?
Huge development. So I was on the seasteading board pretty early on. You know, I was not on the founding board, but most of the founding board members were still on when I joined. And, you know, the huge hope of seasteading is, in a situation like Honduras, we need to get permission of the government. The hope of seasteading was at the open sea. In the open sea, you don't need permission of the government. On the other hand, doing a seastead at open sea is technologically much more difficult than is doing a seastead near shore. So gradually, in order to have something that was both technologically feasible, but also, was easier to do than a land-based zone, the seasteading movement moved towards a strategy of nearshore zones that did have the permission of the local governments, but you could have more freedom offshore. I think just psychologically, if it's not onshore and it's not on an existing piece of land, it's easier for governments to give some freedoms. So that, unfortunately, the Tahiti thing got caught up in local politics. Again, all of these things, notice I was involved in Honduras in 2012. We expect zones there to be announced relatively soon, but one has to learn to think on the pace of decades sometimes with projects like this. And once they get going, they get going. So I'm really excited about the international media that Joe Couric in particular has brought onto seasteading. I've seen articles in National Geographic and the New York Times, and it's becoming a mainstream sort of thing. Technologically, the number of companies involved in various seasteading related technologies is exploding. So I think the technological options for nearshore seasteading is going to be pretty well developed by the time we get a substantial seastead. You know, the Dutch already have great structures offshore and are leading in building these sorts of things. So I see, we need international public acceptance, we need robust, affordable, high-quality technologies, and we need government permissions for greater freedoms. Of those three, I think the government permissions are moving the most slowly, but given my experience with government, we should expect it to move slowly. And bit by bit, it's going to happen. Again, once people realize this is the path to prosperity, boom. I'll give you one real-world example going back to land. In early 2000s, Dubai wanted to create an international financial center. Sharia law, not great for finance. And so rulers of Dubai are very practical. They created a 110-acre zone, the Dubai International Financial Center, which used British common law with a retired British common law judge, commercial judge, as the head judge there within this zone, so that then Citibank and Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs on a global big finance all went to Dubai. Now Dubai is a top 10 global financial center in 15 years. It's been so successful that Abu Dhabi has copied it, and other places are in the region are looking at copying it. Honduras was actually looking at borrowing the Dubai version of common law. So this is on a 15-year timescale. We've seen dramatic success and replication, and I think we're in the early stage of this. Likewise with seasteading, we get one, these things will rapidly grow. I see these sorts of new jurisdictions with higher quality law and governance as one of the leading industries in the 21st century.
Okay, I have kind of a complicated question brewing, so let me see if I can articulate it. So in thinking about the difference between common law and civil law, is it fair to say that common law is a more from the ground up and civil law is more top down?
Very much so. And, you know, over the centuries and decades, the distinctions have become blurred. But, originally, common law organically grew up. It was based on ultimately the customs of particular societies, or the merchant's law. In medieval Europe, there would be professional law merchants who would go from market fair to market fair and offer their services to adjudicate commercial disputes. And the kind of norms around contract and tort liability and so forth that grew up in the merchant's law were then incorporated into British common law. And so we have this organic, evolved system of law that's incredibly flexible. If you look, and by the way, note that that description of legal system coming up from customs and law merchants at no point talks about a legislative body passing law. Hayek is famous for reminding us in the 20th century of the distinction between law and legislation. Sadly, we now think of law as dictates passed by a legislature, and that's really much more in the top-down civil law tradition where the law comes from on high. And so in some ways you can think of common law as the presumption is freedom and spontaneous order, whereas in a civil law top-down system, the presumption is the legislature or even the king controls what you do and you need permission from the government to do what you want to do. Again, in Senegal, my wife has to get permission to fire an employee, whereas ideally we decide what we want to do together. And, you know, if we break up, we break up and we go our different directions. You know, one of the analogies that I'm playing with this is, you know, and I think most people would find it offensive in a romantic relationship for government to tell us what we can or cannot do. And yet in employment relationships, a lot of people want government to tell us what we can and cannot do. It's dreadful.
So I can imagine people coming from a culture that has the more top-down history, that thing that they're comfortable with, but there's and I can imagine people being resistant to change. But the surprising thing with when you introduce economic freedom to a place where they've had a long history and a culture of not having economic freedom, how quickly people adapt. And since you're an educator, I'm guessing you have a perspective on how quickly people adapt to freedom.
Well, I would say there's always a subset. And so it's an interesting question because I think in general, I'm most interested in working with young people because, of course, they adapt more quickly. But, you know, I've given talks around the world and I found that there is a startup culture in pretty much every nation that is very entrepreneurial, very forward thinking. And one of the things about the internet is because the internet is largely a laissez-faire paradise, you can have people in countries with no freedom creating businesses and being successful online. So I've given talks in Guatemala, very traditional hierarchical conservative culture, given talks in Russia. And in some ways, Russia is one of the most closed, depressing cultures on earth. And in both Guatemala and Russia, I found small niches of startup entrepreneurs who are doing online businesses who in many ways were very similar, very optimistic, forward-looking, spontaneous, action-oriented, take initiative, get shit done. So what I see is that whenever there's an opportunity for to create value by means of freedom, there is a subset of a population ready to take that opportunity. I think what's sad is that in many places, it's that freedom is limited to the virtual realm. And so one of the reasons the global poor are poor is because entrepreneurs do not have an opportunity to create real-world jobs for the billions of human beings that need them. So ironically, this notion that government should control the economy is precisely what's keeping billions of people poor unnecessarily. And we need to shift the mindset beyond these small subsets of startup culture islands around the world.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to imagine what will happen when this small percentage of go-getters has the opportunity to move out to sea and create communities full of go-getters.
No, it's really exciting. And, you know, just a very relevant version, refugee cities, you know, refugees are recognized as a major problem with immense numbers of people escaping countries with violence and poverty. And in many cases, there are refugee camps in Africa and the Middle East with three generations of refugees. So it's not just a, you know, 6 months or a year refugee status. It's become permanent. The opportunity in a seastead with a new jurisdiction is the opportunity to create jobs. I'd love to see a seastead in the Mediterranean that was a hotbed of job creation so that all the people in war-torn and poor areas around the Mediterranean could go to the seastead and develop wonderful lives of prosperity and well-being that is not limited by government. I think I'm looking for a paradigm shift, and Joe is brilliant at this, where so many well-intentioned people want to help others by means of, you know, a sanctuary in a church. That's really nice, and you help a tiny number of people. Let's create a refugee city in the Mediterranean where we can help millions of people, not just one. Let's again, part of this is scalable. We could have hundreds of seasteads. We could have hundreds of free cities around the world. There is no inherent limitation to this. The world has been zoned for poverty with these dysfunctional governments, basically prison systems, forcing billions of people to remain poor. It was a stupid thing to have done. We need to get the intellectuals to realize that they're responsible for perpetuating global poverty. Let's create these islands of prosperity, and let's help the millions of poor Hondurans and poor Syrians and poor Senegalese, all these people suffering around the world. As you say, the real question is, why do people not get this? We need more people to get this more quickly so that we can quit unnecessarily forcing people into misery for years and decades of their lives.
I think that's a very powerful point to end our conversation on. So thank you so much, Michael Strong. I think we'll probably need to have you back on again, because I'm sure there's much more we could talk about. So thank you.
Terrific, Carly. It was so delightful to be on the show with you, and go seasteading.
The Seasteading Today podcast is produced by John Bush. Your host is Carly Jackson. Send feedback and questions to podcast@seasteading.org. To support the podcast and the seasteading mission, go to seasteading.org/donate. If you'd like to learn more, read the book, Seasteading: How Floating Nations Will Restore the Environment, Enrich the Poor, Cure the Sick, and Liberate Humanity from Politicians. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast feed, and we'll save you a spot on a seastead.